thanks for coming, everybody. I told Brent, we never know how many are going to arrive, but whoever is here gets a wonderful education in whatever topic of the day. I'd like to introduce Brent McFadden, my friendly neighborhood pharmacist. And our parish health group was trying to think, we decided we wanted to do more on diabetes, and where are we going to find somebody, and what are we going to do, and we researched. Gosh, right under my nose is Brent, because it's Brent's Pharmacy and Diabetes Care. So Brent's an educator. He and his wife also is a pharmacist. They have their doctorates in pharmacy. And Brent just told me the other day he teaches at the tech college, right, the pharmacy techs. And he said, what part of diabetes do you want me to talk about? And he listed off. So I said, you pick, and we ask questions, and so we're glad to have you here. He has two stores. I'm going to give him a plug. One on Bluff and the other right down here in the kind of, well, just at the corner where Ashley's Furniture is located. And it's the neighborhood pharmacy. I have to say my dad and brother were pharmacists back in the old drugstores in Massachusetts. And so going into Brant's is like, as he said, a step back in time. It's just very personal. Anyway.
And thanks. They gave me one already, so I'm already set. Well, it's a pleasure to be with you today, and Alicia is one of our original customers. We opened Brent's Pharmacy 8 years ago, a little over 8 years ago, but 8.5 years now, and Alicia was one of our first patrons, and so she's been a great support and a great help to us, and I appreciate her inviting me to come speak to your group. As she said, we do have two locations, one just right down the street right here. We opened that one just 2 years ago. And the store I spend most of my time at is over on the corner of Bluff Street and Sunset, in the Sunset Corner Shopping Center. And we really wanted to set things up so it felt like you were taking a step back in time, because that's what we felt that a pharmacist needed to have, is some kind of a personal relationship with his patients. And so if that's something that you're looking for, this is my shameless plug, okay? If that's something that you're looking for, we hope that you'll stop in. The pharmacist that runs this store close to your church here is a guy who believes the same way that I do. His name is Dan, and we pride ourselves on getting to know your name. People come in at least weekly and say, I feel like I'm walking into Cheers when I come in here, because we give them the Hey Norm greeting. And so... Just to give you an idea about why we started Brent's Pharmacy and Diabetes Care, my last employer and I didn't really see eye to eye. They wanted me to become the McDonald's of pharmacy business and just pump them out the door. And I don't know how many of you have ever had that experience where you walk into your retail pharmacy and you really don't ever see the pharmacist. You talk with the clerk or the technician, but you don't ever really see the pharmacist. We wanted to put our pharmacists right up front and center, and that's where I always wanted to be. My former employer didn't really agree with that particular vision. And so anyway, we decided to open Brent's Pharmacy. And we knew we needed a niche market in order to be able to make it as a little guy starting from scratch. And so we tacked on the And Diabetes Care. And we kind of advertised ourselves as the diabetes experts. My wife, as Alicia said, is a pharmacist also. She works for the Veterans Administration. There's a VA clinic here in St. George, and she's the pharmacist in that clinic. And so she doesn't do what you would expect other pharmacists do. She never counts pills. She doesn't dispense. She doesn't label anything. Everything that she does is very similar to what a doctor would do. She has a panel of patients, diabetes patients. She has a panel of pain control patients. She has a panel of anticoagulant patients, and she just helps them manage their medications, and she does everything that a physician would do. And we knew that that was kind of what we wanted, and so that was why we set up Brent's Pharmacy and Diabetes Care. We started teaching classes. These are the curriculums from our classes. As you can see, this one was dated October of 14, so it's a little bit back there, but none of the information is outdated. And the title of it is New to Diabetes. And when Alicia and I talked about this, she thought if we just kind of started out with a good broad overview of what diabetes was and kind of some of the main points of diabetes, there are plenty of giant holes we can jump off into as we kind of go through it. And so for the next 45 minutes or so, we're just going to try to run through the general idea of what diabetes are. If you have questions, I hope that this is an interactive forum, and you're welcome to ask questions as we go, and we can jump off as deep into any particular hole that you feel inclined to jump off into, okay? And so with that, let's see, on button. Oh, look, it worked. So this kind of gives you an idea of just the general layout of the way that this whole presentation goes. And we may get to all of these and we may not, but here are every time that we started one of our classes, we'll always start with the basic truths of diabetes. Now, there are two different types of diabetes. If I were to say to you, let's start out with that question. If I were to say to you, if you were to define what diabetes is, how would you define it? What is the definition of diabetes? Okay, your body has a difficult time getting sugar out of the bloodstream and into the cell where it belongs. Okay, I had another picture, and I didn't. I should have imported it into the presentation, but I didn't. But really, that's the whole goal: is to get the sugar out of the bloodstream and into the cell where it can be utilized as an energy source. Now, there are three things that your body really needs, that your physical body really needs in order to live. Do you know what those three things are? Oxygen, water, and some form of a fuel source, and that fuel source happens to be, for most of us, or for all of us, happens to be carbohydrates or sugars, okay? That's the most readily available form of fuel for our bodies. Now, there are other places where we can get that energy source from. We get some from fats and we get some from proteins, but the main source comes from carbohydrates. So really, that's the definition of diabetes, is not being able to utilize the carbohydrates in such a way that it turns into energy for our cells to be able to function, okay? There are two different types of diabetes. One is type 1 diabetes, and type 1 and type 2 differ in a number of different aspects, but that diabetes label is all the same. You still can't utilize the carbohydrates or the glucose very well. Type 1 diabetics typically are diagnosed at an early age in life, usually before the age of 18, some as young as 6 or 8 months old. The problem with type 1 diabetics is that their pancreas no longer produces insulin. And we're going to talk in just a minute about the relationship of how insulin helps us to be able to utilize sugars. And when I say sugars, I'm talking about all carbohydrates in general, okay? So we're going to talk about how insulin helps our bodies to be able to do that. But type 1 diabetics don't make any insulin. And in most cases, not in every case, but in most cases, it's due to the fact that their immune system, for whatever reason, has attacked the insulin-producing cells or the beta cells in the pancreas and destroyed them so that they can't produce insulin anymore. So we call them insulin-dependent. They will always need to have insulin, always, from an exogenous source, or they will die. So that's type 1 diabetic. So typically diagnosed earlier in life, yeah. Great question. And maybe you remember not too long ago, there was a little girl here in our community. Her name is Kaisi, and she was all over Facebook and out in the community about how this little girl had been back to the doctor a number of times, and they thought she had the flu. Thirst, an extreme thirst usually, and this is for any type of diabetes, an increase in thirst, a constant having to go to the bathroom and to urinate. So polyuria is the technical term for too much to having a lot to drink, or polydipsia is having too much to drink. Polyuria means having to go to the bathroom often. Usually some kind of fatigue, very fatigued. If you can imagine, and sometimes that's hard, the only way that that's screened for is through their blood tests. They'll do blood tests on newborns. That's why it's important to keep those well child appointments up. But if your kid was sick and they went in, that was the problem with Kaisi, was that she went in and they thought she had ear infections or the flu, and they never checked her blood sugar. And finally, when they checked her blood sugar, it was somewhere in the 700 or 800 range. And we'll talk about normals in just a minute, but really, that's the only way to tell for sure our blood samples is to tell for sure. So type 1 diabetics will always require some kind of exogenous insulin. Type 2 diabetics is kind of a different story. Usually, type 2 diabetics are diagnosed later in life, usually after the age of 60. Usually, it's associated with a sedentary lifestyle. Not always, but most of the time, it's associated with a sedentary lifestyle. Their pancreas may still produce insulin, and it may still produce enough insulin, but for whatever reason, they've become resistant to that insulin. Now, I guess this is probably a good place for me to interject how that interaction works. We have in our pancreas cells that make insulin, and they're called beta cells, and those beta cells act on signals that come from the pituitary gland in the brain. So when you are feeling hungry, those signals get sent out, and when you consume food, that's when those signals get sent in earnest, and your pancreas begins pumping out insulin to help the sugar move out of the cells or out of the bloodstream and into the cells where it belongs. So the best way that I can explain it is imagine a pickup truck with its bed heaping full of sugar. And it rolls up to the factory, which is your muscle. It rolls up to the factory and tries to get into the factory, but there's a toll gate. And I'm certain that most of you have driven on some kind of a toll road or been through a toll gate where you had to pay a toll in order to go through. The toll that gets paid is insulin. Okay, so a number of things can happen to get the truck through the toll gate and into the factory where the sugar that's in the back can be utilized. If there's not enough insulin to be paid, that's what happens in type 1 diabetics, there is no money. So if you try to get through the toll gate and you don't have any money, it's not likely that the toll gate operator is going to let you through. They're going to say, hit the road. Just keep going. The other thing that can happen is that the operator can be asleep or the gate can be broken. And if the operator is asleep or the gate is broken, you can't get through the gate. And so the sugar stays out on the highway or in the bloodstream just as it was before. So you can keep putting as much money as you want into the toll gate. You can pay as much insulin as there is there to pay. But the gate's not going up, and so the sugar can't get into the factory. Does that all make sense to you? So if the sugar can't get out of the bloodstream and into the cell where it belongs, it just continues to circulate. And eventually, that's what happens when maybe you've heard about ketoacidosis, and that's what little Kaisi died from, was ketoacidosis. They couldn't get her blood sugars down, and so all of a sudden, all of the sugar starts to spill over into the urine. And it causes the urine to smell very sweet, like acetone. And that's called ketouremia. Okay? So that's a life-threatening situation because the brain ends up starving to death and those ketones end up building up so high that it shuts off parts of the brain and can be toxic to this living system. Okay? So that's how insulin works with regard to how to get the sugar out of the bloodstream, okay? Type 2 diabetics may still have insulin. They may still make some, but for whatever reason, the gate is broken or the dude's asleep, and no matter how much insulin we put in, the gate won't go up, and we call that insulin resistance. And so we have to try to find ways to get around that resistance to help rebuild the gate or wake the guy up that's asleep, okay? Okay, so managing diabetes, this is one of our other basic truth slides. Managing diabetes is really a three-pronged process. You know how a three-legged chair stands or a three-legged stool stands. None of Not one of the legs is any more or less important than the other. And those three things that need to happen are, one is maintaining an appropriate diet, two is getting appropriate amounts of exercise, and three is taking medications as they're prescribed to help get the sugar out of the blood and into the factory, into the muscle where it belongs. Okay? And that's really the basic premise that all of our classes are based around. All of diabetic education is based around those three areas to manage diabetes. And so really we can, those are our three big jumping off points. And our rest of our presentation will talk about kind of the general overview of how all that works. I saw your hand up back there. Were you stretching or were you asking a question? Okay, great. I don't want to miss your question if that was the case. So there's our definition of diabetes, a chronic medical condition that alters the way which your body utilizes glucose to maintain its source of energy. So diabetes can be a balancing act, and this wheel kind of shows you just what we just talked about how when you, the pancreas will, well, let's see, let's start right. Where do we want to start? So the pancreas secretes insulin into the bloodstream, and that's all at the response of you ingesting food, okay? So you've ingested your sandwich now, and you have carbohydrates circulating through your bloodstream or about to circulate through your bloodstream. And so the pancreas has received the message to begin secreting as insulin. The insulin circulates through the body, and that allows the sugar to enter the cells. So the toll is being paid to get the sugar out of the bloodstream and into the cells where it belongs. So then insulin lowers the amount of sugar in the bloodstream, and then as the blood sugar level decreases, that signal that's coming from the brain starts to decrease as well, and the insulin begins to back off, and the secretion from the pancreas slows as well. And so that cycle continues to happen. So type 2 diabetes, what are the causes? And I guess before we get into causes, we might want to talk for just a minute about the prevalence of and the morbidity of diabetes itself. Diabetes itself probably isn't necessarily going to kill anyone. However, it produces a whole host of other problems which will kill you. And so diabetics are predisposed to a number of things. Current estimates believe that 1 in 4 Americans may have diabetes, and three of those don't know they have it. Okay, so that's kind of the prevalence that we see of diabetes in our country, and diabetes has exploded probably over the last, I'd say probably over the last 20 years, and we see that happen. And part of the reason is our Western diets aren't very good. That's one thing. And number two, we've created all of these wonderful gadgets and machines to be able to help us so we don't have to work as hard. And so we exercise less and we get less physical activity than we used to get. We've moved from an agrarian society into an industrialized society, and through that industrialization, we don't have to work as hard. So that's another one of those things that has contributed to the great explosion of diabetes. There are a whole host of conspiracy theories out there. We're not going to jump off into that pit. If you don't mind, we'll skirt that pit And I'll just say that there are plenty of conspiracy theories out there about why diabetes has become really a plague to deal with. Now, some of the issues with diabetes. Diabetes is the leading cause of lower limb amputations in the United States today. It's also the leading cause of blindness in the United States today. Both are major issues. And diabetes is one of those diseases, as I said, probably won't kill you in and of itself, but will take you apart piece by piece if not appropriately controlled. Now, that having been said, I want to turn that around, because I'm not a naysayer and I'm not a gloom and doomer. I believe that if anyone were to ever try to ever have to get, or if you were able to pick your own disease to have in this life, this would be the one that you would want to pick, because we know how to control it. We know what we know about causes. We know how to manage it, and we know how to manage it really well. Type 1 diabetics, I actually saw a statistic not too long ago that indicated that type 1 diabetics, it's believed that their actual mortality rate is better than the general population, that they live longer lives. Why would you think that would be? Diet is one, they're aware is the other. They tend to keep their doctor's appointments. They tend to pay attention to their health. They know that they have this disease, and they know that it requires some important management. And so because they're busy managing their health, they have a tendency to live longer than the general population. So once again, I guess that's the flip side of this coin. I guess if I had to wish on myself something, this probably would be one that I would pick, because it's manageable. Now, is it easy to manage? No, not necessarily, and we're going to talk about how all that's going to come. But there are some things that you can control, and there's things that you can't control as far as diabetes goes. And you can spend your whole life worrying about those things that you can't control, but it's not going to do you any good. For example, you can't control your family history. You can't control the fact that you had two parents that had diabetes, and probably you are at risk of developing that because of your family history. There is a family history link or component to this. You can't control your race. Typically speaking, diabetes is more prevalent in African Americans and in Native Americans than it is in the rest of the general population. So that's another thing that you can't necessarily control. You also can't control your gender. And I know that in this day and age, I hope I don't offend anyone, but you're not going to control your gender. If you have a Y chromosome, you're more at risk of developing diabetes than if you don't. So that goes to say, if you're a man, the likelihood you're going to develop diabetes is better. If you had gestational diabetes, if you developed diabetes as a woman when you were pregnant with one of your children, your incidence, or the likelihood that you're going to end up with type 2 diabetes later on in life, goes up almost 50%. Those are some things that you can't necessarily control. In some cases, you can't control at all. But there are some things that you can control, and that lists those right there. Your lifestyle. You can always control your lifestyle. You can decide how much you're going to put on your plate. You can decide what you're going to put on your plate. You can decide whether you get up off the couch from watching your favorite television program and go exercise. You make all of those choices. And so that's one of those things with diabetes that we really encourage people to do, is to be able to control those things that they can control. This is the biggest question that I get asked since we opened Brent's Pharmacy and Diabetes Care. Invariably, every week, sometimes multiple times a week, we have someone walk through the front door and say, "My doctor just diagnosed me as being diabetic. What do I eat?" Those are the first words out of their mouth when they walk in the pharmacy, believe it or not. Okay, so you're in a place where there's medications, and the first question they ask is, "What do I eat?" And I'll tell you that what you eat is the cornerstone of diabetes management. And it lists a number of healthy eating suggestions here. And anybody know what that statement down at the bottom means? Exactly. Vegetables are your friends. And vegetables in multiple colors. The more colorful you can make your plate look, the better off you are, because you get a whole host of the important parts, the important things that you need. As it says right there, minimal starches and carbohydrates. What are starches and carbohydrates? Can you give me some examples? Fritos? Potatoes are starches, yes. I'm sorry? Potatoes, yeah. Sugar is another one. Carrots? Not necessarily. Carrots are actually a complex carbohydrate, so that's not so bad. But white bread is another good one. Pasta is another one. So those are your Those are your starches and your carbohydrates. Yep, we got potatoes over here. Yep, that was the very first thing on the list. Now, as you can see there at the top, it says lean proteins. And lean proteins are better than the fatter proteins. I'll be the first to say that, yes. But really, in diabetes, fats are your friend. And there's been this great battle back and forth for years about weight control. And you'll go to the grocery store and you'll see all of these things that are fat-free. Now, their manufacturers are an interesting group because they've got to try to make it taste good in order for you to buy it, right? And there are about three things that they can do in order to make things taste better. Do you know what those three things might be? They can add sugar. And I heard somebody say add sodium, add salt, and add fat. So those are the three things that you can do in order to make things taste better. Okay? So you go to the store and you see all of this stuff that says low fat or fat free, yet even in spite of all of the anti-fat stuff, people are still fat. Okay? And so wherein is the problem? Well, the problem is that they've just increased the amount of sugar exponentially. And there is now sugar in everything. I ate a peanut butter sandwich this morning, and I just, for fun, looked at the back of the label thinking that peanuts would be the first thing that was on there. It wasn't. It was partially hydrogenated vegetable oil, but you want to know what the number two ingredient was? Sugar. Exactly.
Yeah, there are cookies over there. The dough is sugar.
Okay, and here that brings up a great question, Alicia. What about fruit? You'll notice that fruits appear there on the list. There's fruits, but aren't fruits full of sugar? Fruits are, but it's a different type of sugar. It's fructose and not glucose. Yes, sir? It is. We're going to get to that in a second, so hold that thought. Exactly. And that's how they've made it taste good to be able to purchase, so to get your buying power. So back to fruits, there are some things with fruits. It's a different type of sugar, number one. It's fructose instead of glucose, okay? And fructose, your body has to work a little bit to break it down. It eventually gets cleaved into glucose, but even so, it takes your body a little bit of work to get it there. So one, that's a better kind of sugar. Number two, if you're eating whole fruits, there's this other really cool thing called fiber. And fiber is our friend. Fiber is actually a carbohydrate, but it's a complex carbohydrate. And your body has to work really, really hard to suck the sugars out of that complex carbohydrate. And so because of that fiber, the fiber actually works to cleave some of the glucose, some of the sugar, and sweep it out of the system. So whole fruits are our friend, but that's where we have to look at portion size, and I'm glad you brought that up. Anybody see the difference between a Granny Smith apple and a Braeburn apple? I don't know if you've been to the grocery store lately and you looked at that. Braeburn apples are usually about twice the size of a Granny Smith. Sometimes the sweeter apples do have more fructose in them, so they are higher in sugar. And a Braeburn apple is just that. It's a little sweeter. Like Honeycrisp, that's another one that's a little higher in sugar. So if you can stick towards those other sour type apples, like the Granny Smiths, if you stick towards the more sour and the less sweet apple, you get less glucose, less of that problem. So the question becomes, how much are we going to eat? And we're going to touch on that again just one second. Go ahead, Alicia.
Can you talk a little about glycemic index?
Sure.
Because in that respect, I use a lot of times agave syrup. Is that better than honey?
It is. It is. I don't know necessarily that it's necessarily better than honey, but it's on about that same level with honey. Yeah. Yeah. You get more sweetness for less product out of agave than you do out of honey. So if we talk, so don't let me don't let me get away from our discussion, but I'm going to talk right now for a minute about portion size, and then we'll talk about glycemic index. I don't know how many of you ever saw the movie Supersized. It was a Netflix movie, and it really is kind of gross, frankly. But it wasn't too very long ago, and we're kind of pushing into some healthier ideas, at least at this point. But I know that 7 or 8 years ago, that was about when I think the Supersized movie came out, and it was all about this guy, and that's all he did was eat McDonald's, and he supersized everything. Okay, that's one of the first questions when you go to a fast food restaurant that they ask you today, what size would you like that? So there's small and there's medium and there's large size, and that depends on the size of beverage that you get and your size of French fries. Now think about that for a second. We just talked about those things that were really, really high in sugar. Soda pop is the biggest. And I've had people come into our classes before and say, well, it's okay because I drink diet soda. I don't think diet soda matters because I think it tricks your body into releasing insulin that it doesn't have to release because there isn't any sugar there just because you're taking in something sweet. I think you're overriding the system and you run the risk of causing damage to those cells that are producing insulin merely because you're drinking a diet beverage. So diet beverages, bad. Don't care that they don't have sugar in them. Still think that they're bad for you. Because it goes without saying that all of the other stuff that's in them. And we won't get into all of that dietetics at this point. But I will say this, that as a society as a whole, we way eat more than we need to meet our daily metabolic need. Our daily metabolic need for most American women usually is around 1,500 calories. For men, it's probably somewhere between 1,800 and 2,000 calories. I'm going to tell you a story. It was a few years ago, right after Chick-fil-A came to town. And I don't mean to pick on any singular restaurant or any singular product or manufacturer, okay? That's not my point here. My point here is we just happened to be in there because we hadn't been there before. We'd never been to Chick-fil-A. And we stopped in there one day for lunch, and of course it was, as it always is, very busy. And it was one of the first places I'd been into that listed the nutritional values of each one of their items on their menus. So next to their chicken sandwich, it said 850 calories, okay? And it had everything all listed out. And I think it was the first time that I was really ever paying attention to that, I guess, because I walked in and I'm looking down the list, and I was kind of on a health kick at the time, and I was trying to keep my lunchtime caloric intake somewhere between 600 and 800 calories. And as I'm looking down the list on their menu there, I can't find a single thing on their entire menu that's under 600 calories. Not a single thing. And so as I'm looking, I happen to notice that people are carrying trays of food away from the counter. And as I'm just kind of doing the math in my head as I'm watching them walk away before they ever get to the soda pop machine, and that guy walked away with 3,000 calories on his tray, and that person walked away with, I'm sure it was serving two, but there was about 10,000 calories on that tray. And so I'm watching these people walk away tray after tray after tray with like huge amounts of calories. And anyway, it was too busy and I was starving to death. So I told my wife, let's just go home and I'll make myself a peanut butter sandwich. So we left. And when we got in the car, I asked her, I said, so did you notice all of the food that was going out of there? And she said, well, yeah, there were a lot of people there. I said, no, that's not what I mean. I said, I was looking at their trays, and every person walked away from the counter with at least 2,500 calories on their tray before they ever got to the soda pop machine. Okay? And no, for the most part, most of them were average Americans. There were some overweight people there, but that was my point, was what do you suppose is going to happen in 5 hours from now when it's 6 o'clock and it's dinner time? Do you think that they're going to say, oh no, I had my 3,000 calories for lunch, I'm not going to eat anything now? Probably not. They probably had another 3,000 calories. And I guess that was my point. For the first time, everything kind of, I kind of had this realization, this light bulb moment about, man, we eat way more than what we need to eat in order to meet our basic metabolic need every day. One of the other problems, too, with metabolic need is that we don't exercise nearly as much as we should. Anybody know what the magic number is for how much you should exercise in a given week? 150 minutes is exactly right. 150 minutes. 150 minutes is not that much. 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week. That's all we ask for. And that's kind of the sweet spot. I went to a conference up in Heber City not too long ago, a couple of years ago, and the entire conference was based around aging and exercise. And that was their whole point, was all you need, that 150 minutes a week is that magic sweet spot. Because you don't predispose yourself to injury or other problems, but you get enough to be able to improve your lifestyle and to keep your weight under control. And that's kind of the magic, that 150 minutes is kind of the magic sweet spot. And they talked about it from how it helped in osteoporosis. It talked about how it helped in cardiovascular disease. They talked about how it was helpful in diabetes. So they covered the entire range of problems that can go wrong with this frail human body that we have, and how 150 minutes was kind of that magic sweet spot. And it doesn't matter how you break that up. Everything that you do that gets your heart rate up into a target zone counts. So if you're vigorously vacuuming the kitchen or the living room floor and you get your heart rate up into that target zone and that takes you 30 minutes, that's your 30 minutes for a day. That counts. If you're out washing your car and you're doing it vigorously rather than just kind of meandering through it, but if you're vigorously washing your car and that takes you 30 minutes, there's your 30 minutes for the day if it gets your heart rate up into that target zone. Anybody know what the magic number is for your target zone? It does depend on your age, and it also depends on your level of health. But a good rule of thumb would be probably somewhere just less than twice what your resting heart rate is. So if at rest your heart rate is 70 beats per minute, you want to try to shoot for about 130. Okay? That's, if you get between 120 and 130 and can keep it there, that's time that counts as good exercise time. Okay? Let's see. We touched on portion size. We got exercise. Oh, glycemic index and prediabetes. So when Alicia and I were talking, one of the things that she asked was, what's this new prediabetes diagnosis that the medical profession has come up with? Prediabetes really is, you know, as you're driving north of here, you get out there about 40 miles and all of a sudden you'll see a sign that says Cedar City, 5 miles. And then you'll come a little further and it'll say Cedar City, next 3 exits. Well, really, that's what prediabetes is kind of that early warning sign. There are some of those things we know that predisposes somebody to the full development of diabetes. Now, in order to definitely diagnose diabetes, it takes a couple of different things, and I'm not sure where this slide is here. Let's see if I can find it. There it is. So these are the normal levels for blood sugar, okay? Fasting. What determines fasting? How do you determine fasting? Does that mean you got to go all day without eating before you check your blood sugar? 8 hours. So 8 hours. So usually that's the very first thing that happens in the morning when you wake up, before you have coffee or before you eat or drink anything. That blood sugar would be a fasting blood sugar. And we like those levels to be somewhere between 70 and 130. Okay? You would think that after having not eaten anything for 8 hours, your blood glucose level would be really low. Now, you always have to have some in your system because you always have cells that are working, even when you're sleeping. Your brain is still active. That's why you dream. So there are brain cells that are still acting. Your heart still has to beat. Your kidneys still have to work. So there are still cells that are working. So you always have to have some level of glucose in your system. That's kind of what we're looking for right there, is somewhere in that 70 to 130 range. And the closer it is to 70, the better you are. Okay? Postprandial. Anybody know what that word means? after eating, and we're talking about 1 or 2 hours after the start of a meal, we like to see that blood sugar already recovering from that meal. So we like to see that number below 180. Now, the younger you are, usually, if you don't have type 1 diabetes, and the healthier that you are, the quicker that number will come back to a normal range, and the closer it will stay to that kind of 100. That's kind of the magic number. 100 is kind of that magic number. Okay? So prediabetes, there are some things that predispose to that. So if you spend most of your time somewhere in that 130 to 140 range fasting, the doctor is probably going to slap that pre-diabetic label on you. There is another thing that they didn't put on this little slide right here, and that's another thing that's used as a diagnostic tool for diabetes, and that's called your hemoglobin A1C. Now, a hemoglobin A1C basically tells us how long your blood sugar has been high. This a poke of the finger with a blood glucose meter, a poke of the finger gives us an idea of what your blood sugar is in the entire system at that snapshot in time. And really, it's not all that accurate because you're talking about one drop of blood in a 7-pint system, or in a, I guess, 7-quart system, right? That's about how much we have in our bodies, about 7 to 8 quarts of blood, okay? And we're going to try to tell how that whole system is going from one little tiny blood drop. So really, one singular blood glucose test doesn't tell you much. It gives us a good idea, gives us a good ballpark. But those numbers, if you were to test this finger on this hand right now and then right after that test this finger on that hand, those values could vary by as much as 15 to 20%. It's all just by nature of what and how we're testing. But so really, if a physician was going to diagnose you as being diabetic, he would draw blood and he would check your blood sugar out of that blood draw, okay, because that tests a larger sample from the entire system. And then he would do also a hemoglobin A1C test, and that would tell us how long your sugar had been at a certain level. And that's measured in a percent. The best way that I can help you to picture what an A1C is, the life of a red blood cell is about 21 days, okay? And so as that red blood cell drives through the system, the glucose that it gets absorbed from a gastrointestinal tract attaches to that little cell via hemoglobin, okay? So that's where it attaches, is on the hemoglobin. And the longer it travels around in the bloodstream without being able to jettison that sugar, it continues to add sugar. So if you can imagine my little tiny Nissan Cube car toting around this big giant glob of sugar on the back because it's never able to kick it off to get it in the cell where it belongs, the size of that sugar glob on there is what's measured by the A1C. That's a really simplified version of what hemoglobin A1C is, but it tells us how long that blood sugar has been that high. So for example, a hemoglobin A1C of 5.5 is probably pretty normal. If it starts to get up close to 7, then we probably start thinking about labeling you pre-diabetic. Once it gets over 7, then the doctor probably says, you're diabetic and we need to do something more here. Does that answer that question pretty good, Alicia? Yeah. Exactly. There is no cheating because, like I said, it gives you a general picture of what's happened. It takes in the last 21 days, actually the last 90 days. That's why they won't do one more than every 90 days, but it gives you a really good picture of what's happened over the last 90 days. So if you really do poorly for 50 of those days and you're really, really good for the last 15 days, your A1C is still going to be high. So that's not one that you can cheat very good. Let's see, what was the other one that we had? That one? The glycemic index. Okay, so the glycemic index is just kind of an index that people came up with the American Diabetes Association came up with to kind of rank foods according to how much they're going to affect your blood sugar. Okay? So, for example, those foods that would be high on the glycemic index are things like, well, sugar is like the highest. Okay? It would have a glycemic index of like 100. That would be just plain raw sugar off the spoon. Okay? And so then everything else is gauged according to that index. Now, there are different things that can affect that glycemic index. For example, a red raw potato, okay, so if you were just to eat a red raw potato like an apple, that has a glycemic index of probably somewhere around 20. But if you cook that potato, let's change it to an Idaho russet potato, and you cooked it and mashed it, you skinned it, you cooked it, you mashed it, and then you ate that, that has a glycemic index probably somewhere of around 70. Okay? So the way that you prepare foods, even al dente pasta, everybody knows what I mean by al dente, slightly undercooked, so it's still got a little chew to it, rather than being mushy, that al dente pasta has a lower glycemic index than a well-cooked pasta. Okay? So, methods of preparation. Let's talk about fruit for a second. A banana that's just a little bit brown, even if it's really brown, has a much higher, the browner it gets, the higher it moves on that glycemic index. So a banana that's still a little bit green fits on that glycemic index somewhere a little lower, probably somewhere around 25, but one that's a little more brown ends up being somewhere closer to 80. Okay? So ripeness also affects glycemic index. So really, the whole goal between glycemic index is to help you to gauge whatever it is that you're going to eat and how it's going to affect your blood sugar. So it's just another way of gauging what's going to happen with your blood sugar. Now, if we talk for a second, and that's tangential, I won't go there right now. So glycemic index can assist you in how you manage your diabetes, but it does have its limitations. For example, a Snickers bar has a better glycemic value than a banana does. Because part of the issue is that a Snickers bar has peanuts in it, and peanuts are all protein, so they don't have a glycemic index. Proteins don't show up on the glycemic index because they don't have any glucose in them. They're all protein. Steak is the same way. Chicken is the same way. It doesn't have a glycemic index unless you put the sauce on the top, and then the sauce has the glycemic index. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. Really, any kind of bread, even your whole grain breads are going to be higher on that list than the Snickers bar is. Did you have a question? No, you're stretching. Okay.
So the idea was the more sugar you get, the
worse it is for your brain. Not necessarily, because your brain is the largest consumer in your body of glucose. And so if you start to get hypoglycemic, you guys have seen the Snickers commercials with like Roseanne Barr, and when you're hungry, you're not yourself. Have a Snickers. The Roseanne Barr one is absolutely hilarious. But anyway, and I had that video on here too, but we won't go there. But you know how you feel when you start to get hungry. You start to get a little cranky, and weird things can start to happen. Sometimes you start to taste in your mouth. You start to kind of taste that you're hungry in your mouth. And your body starts doing what it needs to do to help you to understand that it's time to consume some calories. And so when you're hungry, those are the kinds of things that can happen if you're a diabetic, even when you're full, because the glucose isn't getting to where it belongs. And that's one of the things that can happen with a high glucose level is that your brain thinks it's starving to death because it can't get out of the blood and into the brain cells where it belongs. And so the brain keeps putting out that word to the pancreas saying, put out more insulin, put out more insulin. And if the gate is broken, there isn't anything that fixes that. Now, there are some medications out there, and many of you, and I almost hesitate to go down this road just because I've heard all of the bad things about metformin that you can hear. Because the internet is full of them. But I will tell you this much. 25 years ago, we didn't have metformin in this country. It was available in the United Kingdom, and we didn't have it available here in the United States. I was on my pharmaceutical rotations at the time, and one of the two of the physicians that I talked to, that I was working in their clinic as an intern pharmacist, asked me if I could find some way that they could get metformin here in the United States. Now, there is a 1 in 1 million chance of ketoacidosis developing, lactic acidosis, which is potentially life-threatening with metformin. There are some really unwanted side effects that can go along with metformin. I'm not saying that metformin is the perfect drug, but metformin is one of the few things that we found that actually fixes the gate and improves the gate so that you can do better with insulin resistance. It's one of the few drugs, and all of the drugs that we found, and all of the new drugs that have come out. You guys have seen the commercials, I'm sure, for Jardiance and for Ozempic and for Trulicity. All of those drugs are great and fine, but none of them yet has been able to fix those gates that are required, those toll gates, for the sugar to be able to get out of the blood and into the cell where it belongs. No matter what they do, we've not been yet able to fix it as well as metformin can fix it. Metformin is the standard of therapy for any pre-diabetic, and I'm of the opinion that it will be for a very long time to come. So with that plug-in for metformin, what other questions do you have? Reading labels are great, and we actually have an entire class just on reading labels. And so there are a couple of things as far as reading labels goes that you want to pay particular attention to. One is serving size. That's right at the very top of the label. For example, you recognize that you get one of those bags of chips that goes with your sandwich. If you read on the back, most of the time, it'll say serving size on there, and they will break it down to serving size of two, a little bag of chips, and that way they can divide all of those bad things in half on the back of the label. So you want to be cautious with serving size. That's the biggest trick that manufacturer labels will play. Usually 60 is what you shoot for.
How many grams in a teaspoon? Or am I?
Well, and that depends on.
That's my pet peeve.
And that's what you can look for. Typically, that's the number that you're looking at right there is because they'll list it in grams per serving.
Right.
And really for any meal, you don't want more than 60. That's kind of your target number. But you also need to watch for fats and what kind of fats we're talking about. And we could spend a little time talking about that. There are two different kinds of fats. Do you know what those two are? Okay, saturated and unsaturated. Which is good and which isn't? Unsaturated fats are good, and those are the kinds that you find in like avocados. And some of your pure cooking type oils, olive oil is one of those. And if it says polyunsaturated, that kind of fits somewhere in between and still isn't quite as good as an unsaturated fat. And the difference is the length of the chain, the chemical chain that is in those fats, and it. Your body is able to break down the shorter chain dart a little bit better. So those are the two types of fats. How many types of carbohydrates do we have? Do you know what the different types of carbohydrates are? There are two. complex carbohydrates and simple carbohydrates. Simple carbohydrates are sugars, and complex carbohydrates we basically would call fiber, okay? And so fiber is better than the simple sugars, than the simple carbohydrates. And one of the things that you need to recognize too, once again, is that the fiber can sweep some of the simple carbohydrates out. So it's important to have a nice balance of those two. And then really the only other thing that we consume that helps to feed our bodies is protein. There really is only one type of protein. There are a number of different sources. There are some plant sources. Most sources of protein are animal in nature, and they have varying levels of fat. And usually those are saturated type fats. So, for example, except in the case of what type of meat? Fish. Okay? Fish typically have healthy fats. That's why fish tops the list of meats when it comes to the hierarchy of what types of meats to eat. Okay, so fish is best. Typically poultry comes next, chicken and turkey. After that comes your beef, and typically best to stick towards those leaner cuts. Anybody know leaner cuts of beef? Fillets, that's the leanest of the cuts. Flanks are usually okay. So any of those that don't have a lot of fat on them directly off the cow. Probably not ribeye. Yeah, probably not ribeye. Rump roasts, the tough ones that you have to cook for 26 hours to get to soften up some. I'm exaggerating, but rump roast, typically leaner cut than a cross rib roast. Okay? And then somewhere below that comes pork. Okay? And we won't get into the biblical injunction to keep away from the pork. There are lean cuts of pork. We've come a long way in our pork production and the way that we do that now, so I think pork is safe. Yeah? Trans fats are those ones that kind of try to make a hybrid of both. They're still not super good. Did that answer your question? It can be very confusing. And just recognize that really, really fats are our... It is. It's best if you try to steer as clear from those as you can. Well, no. Probably. Well, and bacon grease and Crisco are... Crisco is a trans fat. It's a man-made. Yeah, it's a man-made.
Trans fats man-made then?
Yes.
There are no naturally occurring.
Not that I'm aware of, no.
So you're, that's like margarine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Margarine, Crisco, yeah. Yep.
Now I get it. Now I'm not putting butter with special.
Right. And once again, like I said, a lot of people try to steer clear of the fats, but I'm of the opinion that fats are your friend. In moderation, of course. Nuts do have fats in them, but once again, it's a natural fat, and in most cases, it's a polyunsaturated fat. So nuts are good. Another one is butter. Everybody got in this butter craze that butter was making us fat. I'm not of that opinion. Butter is still great. Yeah. Eggs are our friend. And you don't even necessarily have to go after the egg white. All of my training, I've still never seen, in 25 years of pharmaceutical training, I've still never seen a good study, a good accurate study that can tell me that you can take in enough cholesterol in your diet to really truly affect your cholesterol levels orally. Now, I say that with some reservation in that now somebody here is probably going to go to their doctor and say, well, Ren the pharmacist said that I don't have to follow this cholesterol-lowering diet because you can't take in enough to really affect your cholesterol. Don't do that. I state it as my opinion, okay, and I still, as of yet, haven't seen a good study that shows that you can actually affect your cholesterol to a clinically significant degree by the amount that you ingest. Therefore, eggs are our friends. Eggs are high in protein. They're high in a multitude of vitamins and minerals. They've got everything that they need. They really are. They are really one of nature's perfect kind of foods. Other than that, the yolks are typically high in cholesterol. But your brain needs cholesterol. And I think in some cases, and once again, don't go telling your doctor that this was the gospel according to Brent, the pharmacist, because it's not. But your brain has to have cholesterol in order to form new cells and in order to be able to function adequately. And I think as a whole, as a society, I think we've gotten too aggressive with some of the cholesterol-lowering agents. I think that we've pushed it to a limit that I don't think we've needed to push it to. I think if somebody's cholesterol is 204, depending on what the ratios are, I'm not absolutely sure that they need to be treated. I'm not really sure that they need to go on Crestor. So once again, personal there, that's all personal. Yeah. Well, part of it is from fat. I mean, you naturally take fat in from your diet, but your liver spends some time synthesizing cholesterol. And usually it's a genetic issue. If you have a parent that had hypercholesterolemia, then you're probably going to have hypercholesterolemia. Now, I think that there are levels of cholesterolemia that need to be treated, but I don't think it's nearly as ubiquitous as we've made it out to be. I think that's all big business trying to do that. Aspartame, saccharin, stevia, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's not gonna affect your blood sugar really at all. Number one, because neither of those get treated in your body as a sugar. All it does is add a sweet flavor to whatever it is that you put in. Same with the alcohol sugars. They're going to have that's what they sweeten diabetic candy with, or alcohol sugars. And those will give you gas and cause diarrhea, but they're not going to affect your blood glucose.
What I'm saying is granulated regular sugar and something like Brenda told you about healthy. Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily. No. No, but the one thing that it's going to do, if you take 2 tablespoons or teaspoons or whatever full of sugar in your coffee, that will affect your blood sugar. If you put 2 teaspoons or 2 tablespoons of stevia in there, no effect on your blood sugar. Just tastes sweet.
Well, it'd be the same thing with baking.
Granulated sugar. Yeah. And that's the other thing, too, I guess, that I probably should throw in here is that moderation in all things is one of those religious principles that I hope that you understand. I'm also of the opinion that you don't need to allow diabetes to dictate to you how you're going to necessarily live your life. Now, it will dictate to you what's going to happen down the road. But my whole point with diabetes is I don't think you need to cut out everything that you love. I think you need to be cautious in the number of things that you take in. For example, is it going to be a bad thing if you bake with sugar? No. Is it going to be a bad thing if you eat a cookie today after you have your lunch? No. If you're a diabetic, no, it's not. It's not going to be a problem. It's not a big deal. We know how to account for that cookie that you've eaten. But if you had 6 cookies after lunch today, you've got a problem. Okay? So that's my whole point, is don't, with diabetes, you don't need to quit living just because you have this diagnosis of diabetes. Do you need to be careful with what you take in? Yes, you do. Do you need to be careful with how much you exercise? Yes, you do. You do. So tell me this, which is going to be better? If you go to Chick-fil-A and you order their breaded chicken sandwich, okay? This is just an example, okay? So you go there and you order their breaded chicken sandwich, okay? And so it comes out, and guess what? It's got like 280 milligrams of sugar in just the sandwich itself, okay? So why can't you go there and order their grilled chicken sandwich, which doesn't come breaded? It's just a grilled chicken breast. That's all it is just a grilled chicken breast, and you wrap it in lettuce. Guess what? You just totally cut out all of those carbs. There are no carbs in that sandwich now. And if you're a diabetic, we're not talking about what's happened over the last 3 weeks. We're talking about what's happened over the last 35 years. And that's my whole point here, is that you don't need to allow diabetes to dictate to you how you're going to live your life. As long as you're watching it and as long as you're moderate, I think you're okay. Now, Alicia's getting squirmy, so that means my hour is up. So this slide right here sums everything up for you. There's your summation right there. So make sure that you're attending your doctor's appointments. Make sure that you have a good relationship, both with your doctor and your pharmacist. Exercise together as a family. Find ways to exercise together as a group. It's always funner than doing it by yourself. Go grocery shopping together, and that's really kind of how you support one another. Through this. So anyway, there you have it. If you have other questions, I'll be happy to field those questions.